Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Movie Geeks United special Friday the 13th Uncut Interview Series. This episode we'll be talking to Victor Miller, the screenwriter of the original classic slasher film. Interested in writing at the beginning? Were you always kind of a creative person?
Well, I don't know what I always was. It's much easier at, I'll be 70 in a couple of years, and it's much easier to figure out things looking back than it was when I was actually experiencing them. But one of the hallmarks I have found of people who are in the fiction business is that they are quite good at liars. Early on in their youth, and one of my first memories is lying to my mother about what I was doing with the girl next door, who was semi-nude, as was I, and I think I was 4 years old, 3 or 4 years old, I basically told her that what her lying eyes were telling her was not true, and that my reality was the real one. So I would say that it started there, but I just always had, I loved the movies. I loved radio. I was a child raised on listening to the Theater of the Mind every night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was The Lone Ranger or Fibber McGee and Molly. And I still do that. I use live365.com at night to listen to the old radio shows. On those channels. So I think that all started the thing. And the other thing is that my mother sent me to this thing in fifth grade where we were all supposed to build birdhouses and with wood, and they had a guy teaching us how to do it, and my birdhouse just fell apart. So it was clear that I was not a craftsman, so I had to fake it in order to make it. So that's
yeah.
A short answer, fellas.
What were some of those movies that influenced you? Because I understand that you've never been a particular fan of horror films.
No, well, I think anybody who knows me knows that I am a total chicken, and in 1946 I ran out screaming from we lived on a Navy base at the time, and I used to go to the movies for free, and I think the movie was called Seven Keys to Baldpate, which was a comic horror film, slightly more sophisticated than Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was based on a popular Broadway play of the 30s, and it was alleged that there was a hat in a head in a hat box, just like Mrs. Voorhees's head, and and there I was at 6 years old, and these people were giving each other this hat box, and we never saw the head, and they opened the top, and the head rolled out. It was actually a head of cabbage, but I don't know. The whole thing just undid me. But I never stopped going to the movies. I went no matter what they were, and I just sort of peered out at them. I was heavily influenced by all of the those dark films of the 1940s and 50s, early 50s. Because my parents just sort of dropped me off at the movie theater starting in 1946. It was a different world. You could actually drop a six-year-old off at a movie theater and expect to find him when you came back for him.
Exactly.
I have an eight-year-old grandson now, and I don't let him out of my sight. But they dropped me off at some of these horrible movies with Richard Widmark and Dane Clark and all these. Oh God, that yeah. I mean, I was there. watching when he was Johnny, what's his name, and he had that nasal inhaler he used as a prop and that horrible homicidal laugh. But I loved it all. I was in my 20s when I saw Psycho for the first time, and that was just wow. So later on, I didn't go out of my way to see horror movies, but I saw all of the classics.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, you had started a collaboration with Sean S. Cunningham.
Right.
Far prior to Friday the 13th, isn't that right?
Yeah, we met when I was doing the adaptation for a strange man named Saul Swimmer, who had the rights to a kid's book called The Black Pearl by Scott O'Dell.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So I translated it from novel to screenplay. And in the course of that, during some of the production meetings in Saul Swimmer's office in Manhattan, Sean would stop by, and we were introduced. And I said, well, I've got to go back. I live in, at that point, I was living in Stratford, Connecticut. And he said, oh, I live in Westport. So we went home on the train together, and we became fast friends. That must have been in the mid-70s, early to mid-70s. And I was a freelance writer at the edge of starvation. And he was looking for a way to make money after Last House on the Left, and I guess
right.
most of that had run out. And so we were both kind of on our uppers, I guess, as the old expression goes. And so we just said, well, let's see what we can do. And we kept batting around ideas back and forth and all kinds of stuff. And this was a time when people were lying about what American cinema needed, and they kept saying what the American public really, really, really wants is a good G-rated picture. They lied through their teeth. So we did a couple. You know, we did, I did under a pseudonym, Here Come the Tigers, which was a horrible ripoff of Bad News Bears. Then we did Manny's Orphans, which you'll see on cable every once in a while, about a nice little soccer team. And I actually did that screenplay from an idea by Steve Miner, who was a producer on Friday the 13th and went on to be a director and producer himself. So those were nice, happy little G movies. And, of course, they made no money at all. I think they may have paid back their investment. And then it was, that strange moment in 1979 when Sean called up and said, Halloween's making a lot of money. Let's rip it off.
Mm-hmm.
So that
it's so. How did this idea formulate? I heard an interview with you where you talked about the script was kind of informed by some nightmares that you had as a child or situations that terrified you. But you never attended a camp, as I understand it. So what kind of informed the screenplay?
I was much too afraid to go to a sleepaway camp. As they were called, I went to day camps and all that kind of stuff. But the idea of being away from my horrible parents just seemed too frightening. I don't know why. In many ways, as I look back on that strange experience of my upbringing, I don't know whether it was scarier staying at home or it would have been scarier going away. Somehow, I convinced myself in my 9-year-old wisdom that it would have been scarier going away.
Right.
But in retrospect, I think I would have done much better had I gone someplace else. I once told a psychiatrist that I was very upset they sent me away to boarding school for 5 years. And he said, after what you've told me about your parents, I think those 5 years away from them was the best thing that ever happened to you. At any rate, the long-winded version of I never went to summer camp, so anything I knew about summer camp was based on either my older brother's telling me he went away to Camp Arrowhead somewhere in the South as a child, and he told me about camp, and the rest was just for movies. But the writing of Friday the 13th, the structuring was, as I've said before, it was a fairly simple thing. Once I saw from Deborah Hill and John Carpenter how you do it, and then it was just a question of trying to think up the most fun and scary ways for me of ending a life. And the death of Kevin Bacon that death that he rarely refers to in any interviews or in his resume, was totally informed by the fact that I spent probably every year from 1945 through 55 looking under my bed to make sure there was nothing under it.
Mm-hmm.
And so here finally was my opportunity to have this scary creature under the bed. The idea of having a corpse on top of the bed was informed by the fact that I had been in the Marine Corps Reserve and had been in double-decker beds, so that part of camp was familiar to me. And I often thought of what it would be like if the guy in the top bunk had his throat slit during the night, that it would sort of drip down on me. But I guess that came from some sort of dreamscape of mine.
Yeah. Well, when you're talking about this, it kind of brings up the idea that to write for horror films is kind of does it help to exercise any of these kind of sick thoughts or fears
well,
in your head?
Better on page than in real life.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It is. I think that that not only writing Friday the 13th, but having otherwise nice people like you guys reminding me of things in it and taking me back to it repeatedly, especially in the last two or three years, is even better because, yes, it does exorcise that stuff. And notwithstanding the fact that horror films are not regarded as art, the process is still the same whether you're writing a Chainsaw Massacre or All the King's Men, that you will go deep into your psyche, whether you like it or not, and whether you're writing trash or treasure, as far as the English department is concerned.
Yeah. Were you present for much of the filming?
I was present for a day and a half, I think.
Mm.
At that point, I was on about my next project because I had I'd written the screenplay, and many revisions, and was trying to find out what the next project would be, up to and including my famous story of trying to sell my blood to the people who were doing an experiment about antibodies, and I didn't have enough antibodies, so I couldn't even get the $25 for the blood. But the day I drove down to New Jersey to see what Sean and his people were up to, I had dinner with Sean and Steve Miner, I think the night before, and then the next day I watched them shoot the sequence in which Tom Savini was underneath Kevin Bacon's bed with a hunting arrow and a bladder full of blood. I refer to it all the time as just the best ever, and I cannot help but compare that and the decapitation of Mrs. Voorhees with the sort of CGI stuff that I see now, because you just have, as a craftsperson, you just have a kind of a warm pride in somebody doing that in live, real time, and having to take one for the team as Savini and his assistant did when, in the course of squirting the blood up through the hunting arrow, one of the fasteners let go, and so I think it was his assistant had to, because we could only do it in one take, had to blow the blood up through the tube. So he appeared from underneath the bed covered in blood. But had he not, it would have, just sort of dribbled there and been a real anticlimax. But it was just absolutely wonderful. And to this day, I see it, and I know how it was done. I saw Kevin Bacon sitting in a teeny little chair, and leaning his head back so that they could build a rubber throat and chest down to the blanket line, and I knew how all that was done, and it still scares the hell out of me.
Yeah, it is definitely effective. You never had any intention, or no one really had any foresight that this would take off as it did. So you had no intention of reviving Jason or creating a character that could be revived, did you?
I had no intention. Look, you're talking to a guy who had written I'd written this Sean, with Sean or alongside of Sean, I had written 5 or 6 screenplays, 2 of which had been made and made no money at all, but actually got produced. And here we were again, hoping to just crack through what was then a perfectly good market, the drive-in theaters. And so if we made a hit in the drive-ins, fine. I mean, who knew that that we would become something that became a cult, and that I would go to a scare fest in Lexington, Kentucky, and sign autographs at $20 a pop for my favorite charity. I mean, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The fact that I couldn't sell my blood was all I knew.
Were you at all approached about the other installments, or
no,
just chose not?
They said they were going to do sequels, and I said, oh, okay. And I said, is there any interest in my doing it? And he said, no, because you're too expensive now. The whole deal with the sequel has to be cheaper than the original.
Right.
The rule. That's the general rule of thumb. And so each person who works on a sequel, by virtue of having worked on the sequel, gets too expensive for the next one.
Right.
And
well, fortunately, all the on-screen talent gets killed off, so
they don't have to come back, generally.
Clearly. And of course, as I look back on them, and the reason I never went to any of the sequels was that I had very little interest in Jason, other than he had been this. He was just a causative factor. He was. It would be like doing. Let's say if I were doing the John Carpenter, Deborah Hill movies, I would be writing sequels about a babysitter that Michael Myers killed.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
I mean that's almost a 1-for-1 correlation. Though the babysitter was not a bad character, but if she did come back, I bet she'd be hell on wheels.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And yet, here Jason pops. Look, Mrs. Voorhees was already killing people because of the way they treated Jason, so then Jason pops out of the water because of the way they treated his mother. I mean, it seems a little feeding on itself, but that's the nature of the business.
I'm wondering, when you first viewed it with an audience, whether it was a premiere or what have you, how that experience compares to how you view it now, the last time you viewed it with an audience. I know there's been anniversary screenings. I don't know if you've attended any of those.
I have. I went to, when Crystal Lake Memories came out, I went to the book release party. Is that the one? Let's see. Yeah, Crystal Lake Memories. I went to the party there, and before that they had a screening. And it was great fun. There was a Q&A afterwards, and I looked out and I saw Patton Oswalt and Brian Posehn sitting in the middle of the audience, and I said, "What the hell are you guys doing here? I love you guys." And it was wonderful to see guys whose work I absolutely love sitting in the audience waiting to see my thing. But the differences there are very few differences. And here it is, what, 20-something years, 28 years, I don't know, afterwards. I saw a screening for people in the business, and there was a lot of laughter, so I was kind of uneasy about that because these were all pros and, people like to giggle. But then I saw it with real people in Milford, Connecticut, and then in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and everybody was scared to death, and the effects were perfect, and the impact was exactly what it was supposed to be when we had dreamed it, and it was just great. And I, to this day, I go around, I auction me off at various charities here in Alameda, California.
Right.
That I will come to your house with my copy of Friday the 13th and do a live voiceover, and with you and your friends, as long as you give money to my charity. And so it's great fun to watch them because, half of them are in the bag anyway by the time we see the movie. And still, they get the hell scared out of them.
What is your charity?
It's called Alameda Family Services. It's really a wide thing. It covers people who haven't got enough money. It covers them from the cradle to the grave, whether it's
family
childhood education or pre, drug and alcohol counseling, spousal abuse, the works. So
yeah, well, Friday the 13th really started a trend rolling because it hadn't really previously been in effect of the sequels. And now we have a trend in horror with the remakes. I'm wondering, are you looking forward to the remake? Do you have plans to see it?
I read the screenplay because as part of, I wrote Friday the 13th as a good member of the Writers Guild, and so it was under a guild contract, and they had to send this script to me because there were two categories to pay me. One was, is it a sequel, or two, is it a remake? If it's a remake, then I get more money. If it's a sequel, I get less money. Well, they're talking about it to everybody in the public as if it's a remake, or that elusive word reimagining that they love to use.
Right.
So I read it and I saw, it's basically, it's sort of thinly disguised, kind of, it's my movie, but 20 years later. I'm going to be redundant because it sounds, it felt really redundant. It's kind of the same plot, but you have to accept that everything has already happened first.
Right.
Because it was so thinly disguised, I said, hey, I think this is a remake, not a sequel. And so they had, a panel read it, and they said, no, it's a sequel, not a remake. And I said, okay, so I get less money. But at the same time, they're sort of promoting it as if it's a remake, which it isn't. To me, a remake would be, not shot for shot or word for word, as in Funny Games, but which, by the way, is too scary. I never got through the whole second version of Funny Games.
It's a hard film to get through. It's not easy.
Tough movie, yeah.
It's excruciating.
That's the Victor who couldn't write that kind of horror. That stuff's too good. It's too real, and it just my wife and I just turned it on and said, by the time those kids put on the rubber gloves or the white gloves, I was so creeped out. They were creepier than Betsy Palmer with a machete by far.
Right, right.
So, at any rate, no, I'm not going to go see the remake, and they haven't invited me. I mean, nobody from the production team has the least interest in talking to me. So.
Oh, that's a shame.
What about Sean Cunningham? What about
Sean? Well, Sean sent me an email a couple of months ago because he lost a copy of one of our contracts and wondered if I had one. But basically, I don't know whatever happened to me and Sean. We were best friends, and Hollywood got in the middle.
Right. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry to hear
me
that.
Me too. We were really, for, I don't know, a couple of years there, we were each other's best friend, and then success happened. So you be careful what you pray for.
Right.
Right. Right. But your career has really taken a unique turn. You've written. You've written books. You do voice work, and you write. You're an award winner for writing for soaps, and that's a strange leap from Friday the 13th to the soap opera world.
It really was, except if you sat down and had several coffees with me, you'd find out that my mind is. I think what I learned after all of these years, or in the middle of all of these years, is that I'm really good at putting stories together. I am not the most inventive, original mind you'll ever find. But if you tell me, as I did with Friday the 13th, if you tell me to go and look and see what Halloween did, I can find the structure of that, and I can find a way to make it new. There's an old expression in the radio writing and TV writing business that I learned from one of my early mentors in the soap opera field. Her name was Peggy O'Shea, and she said, let's give the... What I said, she said, she talked about some movie, I've forgotten what it was, Wait Until Dark or something like that. She said, let's give that movie a haircut. And it's an old showbiz expression meaning let's steal that movie, only make it look different.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's give it a haircut. So I can give almost anything a haircut and do, as we've seen, fairly well with it. When in 1982... I'd done well with Friday the 13th, and I'd done well with a couple of projects afterwards that never got made. Sean and I did Stranger is Watching, the Mary Higgins Clark book, that did not make a lot of money. They publicized it the wrong way. They said from the people who brought you Friday the 13th, which led the audience to think it was going to be another Friday the 13th, but it wasn't. It was a Mary Higgins Clark book. At any rate, the recession of the early 80s hit, and I was starting to look like I needed money to send my kids to college, so somebody said, you want to write soap opera? And I said, sure. And I found that if you put me in a room with a lot of soap opera writers, I can come up with plots and storylines and characters, and I enjoyed writing for Tad and Hillary and all those people and all my children,
mm-hmm.
which suited my sense of humor. And so I spent the next 25 years. I mean, it was a regular paycheck, and you can't beat that as a writer.
Right.
And every day you go in and you have to solve problems, which is what my mind loves to do. If you say, well, look, we've got Tad and Hillary and we've done everything with them we can, what's next? And if you put me in a room with people, I will help come up with some fun stuff to do.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Miller, I appreciate your time so much.
Yes, thank you.
And
my pleasure. Jerry, Jamie, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
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 Now. Thank you.